From RTE Radio, I'm Nilo Shirathon. This is Playback Daily.
How can I do this? All these words cannot possibly be in my head.
It is very irritating if you get into the train, which is really comfortable, and you have to listen to people talking about their business.
When I actually auditioned her for the drama, she was working in a convent off Sheriff Street.
Coming up on this last day of the month edition of Playback Daily, not enough headspace, an actor's experience of stage fright, the conversations of others, why all trains need quiet carriages, and Peter Sheridan on casting his play Philo. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's recording on the 5:15 to Tralee. And first up today, as part of his morning monologue, Oliver Callan made the mistake of looking at the state of the world.
In the wider world, and I'm afraid it's political tumult for the week ahead.
Just like the week just gone, and next week, and every week for at least the next 4 years.
The trade war apparently begins on Wednesday, the 2nd of April. The US is coming for our farm industry that has been propping up Ireland all these years, even though the concentration, I suppose, has always been on big tech, but it really was the pharmaceuticals, really is. And the EU is reading over the weekend, they might retaliate. They're thinking about taxing the heck out of tech because they're so close to Donald Trump. So there are ominous times ahead for the Irish economy as well. And as the Dáil, of course, it's entering another week of cacophony and that tiresome drama around the Ceann Comhairle, who's facing confidence motions, although Verona Murphy will survive, but hardly unscathed. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe Michael Lowry and his friends will get to do their first leader's questions, this time under the new, very controversial rules. That'll be a tough day out, won't it, for the sign language people, given Deputy Lowry's poor understanding of hand signals, we'll put it in as kind a way as we can.
Not sure that kindness is entirely merited, but let's let it pass as we dwell on the bigger, uglier, oranger picture.
Now, unfortunately, the story making waves overnight is not very entertaining because Donald Trump has been talking about the methods, if not plans, to circumvent the constitutional limit that prevents him serving a third term. This is an interview that was put out on NBC. Actually, there's no clips of it. He spoke on the phone to a journalist who then just read out his quotes. It's kind of strange. But basically, he said, when asked about his constant references and asides about maybe he'll do a third term and maybe he'll do two terms at least, he said this time he's not joking about the third term. There are methods about which way you could do it. And the presenter of NBC's Meet the Press kind of alluded to a purported loophole that Trump supporters have been putting out there, saying, well, maybe he could be the running mate to Vice President J.D. Vance. So J.D. Vance would be the main guy on the ticket in 2028. Trump would be the vice president pick. And then Vance would just simply resign and then Trump would take over by succession. And that would be apparently an argument to circumvent the 22nd Amendment, which prevents a third term. Explicitly, the fans of his say it explicitly bans being elected to more than two presidential terms without saying anything about becoming commander in chief on an additional occasion through succession, as in a veep stepping up to the mark. However, J.D. Vance has never said he's interested in this plan or has even alluded to it. And an election law professor told the Associated Press the Constitution's 12th Amendment says no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president can be eligible to the office of the vice president. So there you go. So if he's not eligible to run for president because of the amendment stopping him running for a third term, he wouldn't be eligible to be to run for vice president either. There are two other routes for him, which is to change the constitution. Both very difficult. He can't unilaterally remove an amendment. A two-thirds majority vote of Congress, followed by ratification from the majority of voters in three-quarters of the states across America, given the slim majority the Republicans have in the House and Senate, and the polarisation in the electorate. No hope there. And the other route is two-thirds of the states, that's 34 states out of 50, agree by referendum that they may have a constitutional convention. But even then, if they went through the convention and the proposal was to remove the 22nd Amendment, a majority vote in three quarters of all the states of America would be needed to ratify. So it looks kind of impossible. It looks absolutely impossible for him to do the third term. The 22nd Amendment was only brought in 1951 and it was aimed at preventing presidents serving more than two terms to stop the country basically dipping into the autocracy that they saw in 1951. The Second World War was very raw for them. And any efforts, of course, would go to the Supreme Court. It is majority Republican, but he would have to obey. They would have to go by the Constitution, basically. because he could attempt to defy the highest court, which has happened twice previously. Andrew Jackson and Abe Lincoln did it, no doubt. But keep an eye on that. It could be just a distraction to everything else that's going on, because now looking at all the press in America is leading with that story about the third term, and also saying he's going to cause pain for Putin.
It's the game played out in the media of, did he say it? Did he mean it? He's never going to do all that stuff he said he was going to do during the election, is he? Oh, look, he's doing all that stuff he said he was going to do during the election. Didn't see that coming. Makes me sad. And you know what's good for making sad people not sad? That's right, Pierce Brosnan.
He's 71 years of age now, still a hit. In fact, the photograph I'm looking at him in the Irish Daily Mail this morning put you in mind of a bit of a Sean Connery in the Entrapment era. Remember when he had that nice, very fetching wig and that unlikely scenario of him and Catherine Zeta-Jones? And the Irish Daily Mail tells us that you can take the boy out of Navan, and apparently the accent too. Pierce Brosnan has admitted he had to get dialect lessons for his new role playing an Irishman in a streamer series, Mob Show, which is directed, some of it anyway, by Guy Ritchie. It's a drama series called Mobland. And there's a politician's voice. He was used, his coach basically, his dialect coach, used a politician's voice to perfect the accent. We'll come to that now in a second. By the way, this is written by Sarah Slater. It's a good name to be in the Daily Mail, isn't it? Slater. Very, 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 very fitting. So we know Pierce Brosnan. He was here till he lived in Ireland till he was 12 years of age, and then went across to England. And he's got a very mid-Atlantic brogue, and of course he would have had to change for James Bond, which is a British role. But people are pointing out the trailer and saying, "Oh, suspect accent here." Where are we here? Here, this bit.
Name Conrad Harrigan, family man. And if you cross my family, well, you'd better pray. We shake the right hands, break the wrong ones. We don't ask, we take. And when someone forgets their place, I've got a man for that.
Pleased to meet you.
My wife's the brains behind the charm. She holds me together. That makes her the most dangerous of all.
The second you lose trust in me is the second this family turns to dust.
Hope you get that!
So, are you with us or are you against us?
Oh. Just one word there in an Irish accent at the end. Fair play to Pierce. That was Helen Mirren, by the way, who, from what I could tell, is doing a Northern accent, which she has done before, and she went out with Liam Neeson for a while there. What is this all about? Well, Pierce Brosnan is playing Conrad Harrigan, a Don Corleone-style patriarch of an Irish mob family that controls a huge criminal network from their English estate. And the cast includes Helen Mirren, as you heard there. She's a psychopathic wife, Maeve, basically. And Tom Hardy is the family's fixer, and he does his thing, as he always does, looks mean, nasty, and mumbles quite a lot. But for that accent, which basically you can kind of tell he's trying on a Kerry accent, and the press says that's how he was trained for the role. Although I see the London Times says, it's lucky that Brosnan, as the barber-wearing crime patriarch, is actually Irish-born and bred, or I'd have assumed that his fiddle-de-dee accent was completely OTT. Mirren speaks in an equally broad Irish blarney that would be distracting if he weren't so gobsmacked by her cold-blooded sociopath. Pathic nature, and they give it 3 stars. They're saying it's a generic organised crime gang fare, but every time Tom Hardy shows up, you'll find it impossible to look away, or look away, as you might say. But in the Mail, they point out, for his role, the coach helped Brosnan to master his dialect by listening to tapes of a politician, an unnamed politician, with a Kerry accent. But he's doing it very slow down. That's why it sounds weird to our ears, because we dug deep and we did find Michael Healy-Ray, the odd time, speaks kind of slowly.
And the way I would word it is, the work that we have done, myself and Denny, in conjunction with the county councillors, we are ensuring that government are taking on board the issues and the concerns that are in County Kerry. And of course, remember, if they're in County Kerry, they're reflected throughout the rest of the country.
Country. That's very important. It's a kind of a junior infants Kerry dialect coach there going, we are now today doing a Kerry accent. Now, when you're listening to trailer, often the trailer is recorded in a studio booth. He has time to record the accent and so on. But it's all about the heat of the scene. And Pierce Brosnan, I think you can detect the Kerry.
It's always the same.
Bit of Kerry
in
sings
any
on.
Orchard.
In any orchard.
You plant the trees.
Ooh.
The trees grow tall.
Oh, he's losing it big time.
And sooner or later, they begin to get mangled. And before you know it, the apples start to rot. And that, Harry, my son, is pruning time.
He's doing the kind of thing that they taught him to do. But then he's used the word, which is very telling, mangled. Which might be the summary. The Guardian also gave it 3 stars. This Guy Ritchie gangster drama is so cartoonish you could dismiss it as crass twaddle. But watching Tom Hardy threaten people is irresistible. And the Hollywood Reporter is criticising Helen Mirren there. Hardy and Pierce Brosnan offer mumbly menace in derivative crime thriller. It is on Paramount Plus, which you have to pay for.
Paying for content? The very idea of it. Although, given that it's Pierce Brosnan, it's probably worth it no matter how much it is. Finally for this monologue, from the Irish James Bond to the Irish Eurovision songwriter, but for Armenia.
We are obsessed with Eurovision as a nation, it would seem. And there's an Irish-Czech singer-songwriter who has penned the song for Armenia this year. Joshua Curran is his name. Says incredible experience. His mum is Czech, his dad is Irish. Curran, obviously that'd be the Irish bit. And he spent his summers at his granny's house in Tramore in County Waterford, which has produced a few songwriters down below, Moncrief and so on. I have loads of cousins from Waterford and Dublin. We holiday together as a family, and he describes himself as Irish-Czech. So he's a multi-instrumentalist. He only turned 20, and he has penned this song. We have a little clip of Survivor.
I'm a survivor.
Armenia. Oh, that's the Eurovision bit for sure. Oh, a bit of heavy metal as well. They've kind of like done everything, a bit of pop, heavy metal. And also you see the images of the singer. He's covered in soil for reasons that will never be explained because it's Eurovision, basically. Remember Malta? We were talking about Malta on this show as well, they've been forced to change the lyrics of their song because it was serving, they were saying serving cant, which is the Maltese word for chant and song and so on. But everybody could see what they were really doing. And so they've had to remove the offending word. Did they replace the offending word? Let's see what they've done, serving. Serving. Oh, nothing. Somebody crying for help there in the background. So they've left it blank there, obviously, to let the audience fill in. They're very clever. That's a kind of a viral thing that's going on there. Serving brunch. So we think they're saying that's what our team this morning thinks is going on.
There are worse things to be served, of course. Brief bit of Eurovision madness there to end our excerpt from this morning's Oliver Callan monologue. Chinese electric vehicle maker BYD has come up with what it calls a revolutionary new public charging technology that will deliver a full charge in just 5 minutes. Claire Byrne discussed the significance of this for the changeover from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles this morning with motoring journalist Neil Briscoe and Daniel Murray, policy editor at the Business Post.
So Daniel, these BYD superchargers, they do sound like a bit of a game changer. Do you agree? Are they?
Yeah, I think they are. So BYD, they're the Chinese firm that have surged in popularity in recent years. They unveiled their new supercharger a couple of weeks ago, and it kind of took the industry by surprise. And the new technology can apparently charge an EV battery to a range of 400 kilometres, which is quite far, in just 5 minutes. And that is a game changer when you compare it to an average of 30 minutes for normal fast chargers. And it's still more than twice the speed of the Tesla superchargers, which really would have been the next in line in the market. So as the Chinese company said themselves, this would make refueling an EV a little like pulling into a petrol station and putting petrol or diesel into your vehicle. And from that perspective, in terms of the psychological barriers for the mass market, I think that still remains to adopt EVs, I think it could be a game changer.
But do you know it need a whole infrastructure around this so that the 5 minutes is really 5 minutes? Because at the moment, do we have that? Could we actually feasibly have this system?
No. This is specific to BYD technology. So it's specific to the battery packs that would go into their cars, of which it's going to go into two new models that are coming out and so that aren't actually available in Europe and in Ireland just yet. And then, of course, it requires the charging infrastructure as well. And this would be very specific BYD charging infrastructure. And it's something that makes BYD slightly different as an EV maker, is that it has IP across charging infrastructure, battery packs, and the actual vehicles themselves. So it'll be a number of years before we see these kind of superchargers rolled out in Ireland. BYD have said that they're going to roll out 4,000 of them in China to begin with. Mm. So it'll be a while yet. We do have some Tesla superchargers in this country. I think 10 or 15 of them are rolled out across the country. So not very many as well. And those being able to charge in 15 minutes plus to about the same degree. So we do need the infrastructure to be put in place for those super fast charges. And in fact, we need the infrastructure to be put in place for charging full stop,
in
even
general,
slower charges.
Because it's really quite poor, isn't it? I mean, you have the bank of Tesla chargers you see sometimes in the charging stations. There could be 9 of them, and then you'll have 1 or 2 for everybody else.
Yeah, it is poor at the moment, and it is one of the reasons why there was a slowdown in EV sales last year, is that the rollout of that EV charging infrastructure has been slower than was hoped. So ZEVI, which is the kind of the Department of Transport's office for electric vehicles, they put in place targets of rolling out up to 6,000 public chargers by 2030. At the moment, we've gone from around 1,700 two years ago to 2,500 now, so we're still a good bit off being able to reach that target. So it has been slow, and it's being facilitated not only by the government, but there has to be rolled out by private forecourts as well. There's grants in place to be able to support them to do that, but it's not happening.
Okay,
apace.
I hear Neil's line randomly beeping there. Neil, are you still with us?
I am indeed.
Ah,
yes,
great. Morning. Okay, listen, you have had the advantage of being in a BYD factory in China. What was it like?
It's I suppose terrifyingly impressive might be the best way of putting it. I mean, the amount of industrial muscle that BYD has is really quite something, even if you are used to seeing behind the scenes at the likes of Toyota and Volkswagen and Ford and so on. What BYD can do, what it is capable of doing, is really quite staggering. Now, I suppose that comes with the caveat that, you know, not many labor unions in China. Their employment practices might not be the same as ours. And obviously they're getting a lot of government subsidizing and funding from government in China, which, you know, those are issues that we have to consider. But yes, in terms of what they can actually do and turn out, it's enormously impressive.
And we know that they're subject to heavy tariffs in Europe, but are they still competitive price-wise despite that?
Yes, they are at the moment, because BYD knew that the tariffs were coming in, so they brought in a lot of stock into Europe before the tariffs were imposed. And also, in the next 18 months, they're going to be opening two European, one factory in Europe, in Hungary, and another in Turkey, which of course has agreements with the EU for exports and imports. So BYD will effectively be skipping the tariffs for the most part once those two factories are online.
Okay, I was speaking to Daniel there about whether, you know, when we get to the point when these cars are available to Irish consumers, the ones with the 5-minute charger, will we have the charging infrastructure then to be able to support them? Now, it seems from what we've been told so far by Daniel, we don't, but is it on the way?
Well, you'd have to hope it's on the way. Now, I think there's the really big part about this is not so much necessarily the speed of the charging that's going to be available. It's the fact that BYD is now talking about doing its own charging network. It's basically talking about doing a Tesla and building its own chargers and expanding them out into the markets where it sells its cars. And that's a really big move for BYD. Hasn't done this before. And indeed, most car companies do not have their own charging networks. Tesla is very unusual in that respect. So that could be a massive game changer in and of itself. Never mind the 1 megawatt charging speed, never mind the 5-minute 400 kilometer top up. The very fact that BYD will be installing its own chargers is very big news. Mm-hmm. And what they have said is that in order to make sure that these chargers can pump out that kind of power, is that they will have on-site power storage. In other words, they'll have a huge bank of static batteries buried under the ground, or you know, possibly in some kind of storage container or something next to the charger, and those batteries will be kept trickle charged, and they will then be able to, you know, shunt out that enormous megawatt power.
So they wouldn't be relying on the state infrastructure at all then if they go down that road.
They would certainly be insulating themselves from it, because getting a megawatt of power to a single charger is a heck of an undertaking. You know, you're talking about building substations, you're talking about building local transformers. I mean, even for the current lineup of very fast charging points, we kind of need to do that, and that's why a lot of them are quite slow rolling out, because we're, you know, a lot of the charging companies and providers are waiting for the ESB to build out the infrastructure that allows for this kind of power.
Okay, and Daniel, the plan is, or the ambition here, is that we would have charging stations at regular intervals on our motorway network. Isn't that it?
Yeah, that's the idea. So as part of the new road network charging plan, which was put out by ZEVI in the last year, the idea is that every 60 kilometres on the motor network, you would have some of these fast chargers in place and that you build that infrastructure up over time. And they have announced that 131 of these are going to be put in place over the next while, and funding has been provided for it. But there's a difference between that and getting to the scale of chargers. It's almost a tripling of the charging network that's needed over the next 5 years. And that's, of course, if we even manage to hit the number of EV sales over the next number of years that we're hoping to hit, which will obviously facilitate this charging network as well. So there's kind of a chicken or egg situation here going on as well, and targets on both sides from the government.
But what is the delay? Like, if the funding is in place for this, the plan is there, why is it not happening?
I think it's a combination of it's not just government funding that has to do this. It's about incentivizing private operators to put them in place. And I think it was Maxol late last year that said that because the slowdown in EV sales, they were actually not going to be able to roll out charging infrastructure as fast as they wanted to. So one is kind of begetting the other, and one is slowing down the other. So that's why the government is trying to intervene in the market and provide some of these supports so that it does scale up in time. But they have a long way to go to be able to reach those targets on both sides, the EV sales and on the charging network. So if
that's policy editor at the Business Post, Daniel Murray, talking this morning to Claire Byrne and motoring journalist Neil Briscoe about the game-changing nature of EV maker BYD's new charging technology for electric vehicles. We'll get there at some stage, won't we? Won't we? On this afternoon's Liveline, Joe Duffy heard from Alice, who had a little tale to tell from a trip on the Dublin to Sligo train.
I was just, minding my business, reading. And, I just started to hear this meeting on Zoom. The man was on his laptop, probably three or four rows in front of me, and it was like I was in the meeting. I heard them discussing budget issues and people's names, and I don't know, it was some kind of council meeting or something like that.
Okay.
It was a private meeting that I was really a part of because I was sitting on a train.
And even though you mentioned three or four rows, he wasn't using headphones.
No, he was on the laptop with no headphones. So
you could hear him and them.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Yeah. I waited for a while thinking he was going to sort it. And then I went up to him and said, excuse me, but I'm in your meeting. I hear everything, including budget numbers.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me like I wasn't there. He just blanked me. And so I went back to my seat and just tolerated it for the rest of the trip.
And did the meeting go on?
Yeah, it went on. Yeah, I just tuned it out after that, Joe, really. But it went on. It went on till we got to Sligo. It might have ended, wound up just before that. But anyway, I tried and, kind of rolled. The other passengers around me were rolling with their eyes as well.
And do you think
it's not the
people?
First time.
But do you think the people on the screen who could be heard by and seen by you or seen by people nearby, do you think they knew they were in a public meeting?
No, they didn't. And he was on mute, so when he wasn't speaking, he had his microphone muted. So they didn't hear me interrupt him. I was kind of hoping they would,
and they couldn't hear the rickety. Well, there's not much of a rickety rack on the track anymore, but that beautiful rhythmic sound.
Yeah, the announcements of when we were getting to stations and stuff. He was on mute, so they weren't hearing them.
Okay, and previous experience, as the fella said.
There are, I've heard over the years. I've heard lots of phone conversations and arguments between couples and, all kinds of stuff. But I said, when I contacted you, I said, in Poland, they have a great solution, which is just on the longer train routes, the equivalent of Dublin to Sligo. They've got a silent car that you can book that ahead. And it's just, it's a car that has digital screens in it that tell passengers the rules, which are, if you have to make a phone call, make it short and quiet. No loud conversation and no music. And when the conductors come around, they check, if somebody, I was on once when somebody was having a loud conversation and I saw them, ask the people to be quiet. But it's just, to me, it seems like an easy start towards addressing the problem so that people like me who I really value quiet can just, you know, book it and not get into ructions with people who are, you know, in Zoom meetings without headphones.
Well, that's not the problem. The people worry they might get into a row that they don't want. They don't want.
Exactly.
Stay with us for a sec if you can, Alice, because Patricia was on the famous Blue Mountains train in Sydney, but you were checked, weren't you, Patricia, by another passenger?
Oh, hi, Joe. Yes, on the way back, we just went into a carriage, my husband and I, and I talk a lot. And then this lady kind of put her hand up and I looked and she pointed to the sign.
And the sign's...
Quiet carriage.
Quiet, okay. And how did you get on, Patricia?
I kept quiet, Joe.
Oh, okay. And was that difficult, Patricia?
Well, we could have moved carriage, really, couldn't we, Joe?
Well, it's a bit it a bit unfair? You're on a beautiful train, a beautiful scenery, and you can't chit-chat to your travel companion, even in a whisper.
Well, maybe I did whisper in our time, but I actually thought, it's fair enough. I actually don't mind chatting on trains, people, but other people would like it quiet, and they had the choice, didn't they?
Ian Rode Aaron have been on to say they have a quiet carriage on our Cork services and it is very well received, so to speak.
Yes. Well, we're Galway Dublin.
Well, you'd never enforce a quiet carriage on the Galway train. Patricia, stay there, Patricia. Laura, good afternoon. Laura.
Good afternoon, Joe. Welcome back.
Thanks indeed. You were on the Westport train.
I was on the Westport Houston on Monday week, last week. And I haven't been using the trains at all of late. So I decided to use it on Monday. I was away in the West for the weekend. And there was a man opposite me on two FaceTime calls discussing his hangover and where he was going the next night. And there was another young man who had music, but he actually turned it off. My main point, Joe, is that there should be a quiet carriage on every train. Mm. And I know Erin know there and have one on the Cork Dublin route. Their explanation for that is it's a longer train and there's more people on it.
Yes.
Now, sorry, excuse my language, bullshit. Like, that's nonsense. So there are people on the Galway Dublin. There are people on the Westport Dublin who would like a quiet train. And they say that I did a little bit of research on it, that disability groups in particular like these quiet carriages for people who have autism or Asperger's or dementia, that they work very well. And they claim that 300,000 people benefit by this quiet. So why is it only on Dublin Cork? It is very irritating if you get into the train, which is really comfortable, and you have to listen to people talking about their business.
Well,
so you should be a quiet option.
You've already given the Ian Road Aaron reply, but I'll give it again. They say, we have fewer services on the Westport route and the Cork route. We've 8 carriage trains every hour, on the hour, whatever the time it is, and we've more space, basically.
But, Joe, that really doesn't make any logical sense, does it? I mean, if there are people travelling... Even on a shorter train, it doesn't matter really what length the train is. I know they're saying that there's more room for people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get into a quiet carriage by mistake or because there isn't another seat, then you have to abide by that rule. You have to be quiet.
And who will police it?
Well, my ticket was checked twice from Westport to Houston by a ticket inspector, twice. So surely he could double up and say, sorry, but you're in a quiet carriage. Can you turn that off?
Ian Rode Aaron again, we've a campaign. I'll whisper this. Ian Rode Aaron say, we have a campaign where we regularly publicise on all our services, encouraging people to be mindful of others and to whisper and speak quietly on your phone and use headphones if you're listening to music and other content, which is back to normal level on the train.
That's nonsense. Yeah, that's really doesn't make sense.
But is it
quiet
is there,
carriage on the train?
But are we not just asking? We're not just encouraging people to take care of others and cognizance of others.
Yeah, absolutely, of course we should, and people shouldn't be shouting on trains. But if you put four, particularly women, around a table in a train, and they're going home or they're going away for the weekend, they're not going to sit there in silence.
That's Laura talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about the absence of quiet carriages on all but one of Éireann Road Éireann's intercity train services. And also making a possibly controversial and definitely sweeping allegation against a theoretical group of women sitting around a table on a train. Those of a certain age will remember Ballycasangel on TV back in the 1990s. It was the show where Colin Farrell got his first screen role, and it was also the show where busy stage actor Peter Hanley became very familiar to Irish audiences. Hanley also had a memorable turn around the same time as the Prince of Wales in the movie Braveheart. Oliver Callan had Peter Hanley on this morning, and the actor spoke about the terrible stage fright that gripped him from 2011 to now.
So the show was Molly Sweeney by Brian Freela. It was for the Gate Theatre, and we'd done all of this, and we'd done our tech, and it was the dress rehearsal. And I should say it is a monologue play. So there are three actors on stage.
Aha, okay.
And we are delivering our lines straight to the audience. So there's no dialogue as such. It's all
no crossover. There's no one interrupting, or you're not waiting for a cue, things like that.
No, exactly. Yeah.
That's harder, obviously.
Well, so it seems. so it seemed anyway.
Dress rehearsals and you're in full costume. You're ready to go.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have all the production elements. You have the lights and everything. And you have just an audience of maybe 20 or so. Some of the, you know, the PR, front of house, box office, and the director, the writer. I think Brian Friel was in. And,
wow.
And the director, the producer. But you say, is it harder? I mean, It can be. I mean, I've spoken to other people who've done monologue plays. It feels a bit lonely.
I see, yeah.
It can do. But, you know, I knew the lines. I knew them. We had gone through, we'd done run-throughs of it in the rehearsal room in week four a couple of times. I knew them. I just, in this moment at the dress rehearsal, I couldn't believe that I knew them, that they'd all be there waiting for me. In my head.
The doubt started to come in.
Is this
like a thunderstruck moment? It is a moment that happens to you, is it?
Yeah. I mean, and that was the I didn't see it coming at all. Over years and as you say, decades of work. It was a voice in my head when the light came up on me. So the other, I think I was third, the other actors had done their first monologue. You alternate monologues throughout the evening. And when the light came up on me, I just was overwhelmed. It wouldn't have shown to anyone watching, but I was overwhelmed by this sense of it being impossible to do this. How can I do this? All these words cannot possibly be in my head. So it's irrational in a way. And some, you know, therapists might say it's not helpful actually to call it irrational, because it feels entirely rational and reasonable and
real to you,
and
yeah,
the truth to you. But it's as irrational as again, I talk about this in the play. I mean, what all the different things we're afraid of, phobias. Like, I'm fine, for example, with flying. If it's a bit bumpy, I'm not mad about it, but I'm trying to equate my thing sometimes with the fear of flying, and you hear people saying, no, that big metal lump cannot stay up in the air. It cannot. It's not safe. I'm not safe to get in there.
Start to doubt science. And,
yeah, exactly. and also doubt facts, doubt the proof of
objective reality.
Yeah, because what
How
happened?
How did that dress rehearsal go, by the way?
So, yeah, I was going to say,
I think if I was watching it, we wouldn't have noticed that.
No,
that problem.
Except I did call for a line, which I've never done during a dress rehearsal. So the stage manager is just off stage and they're on the script. And I was so distracted and overwhelmed by the voice in my head saying, you can't do this. You've got, you know, a couple of hours of this ahead of you. You can't. Shared with the other two actors, but you. So the voice in the head distracted me. I called for a line, and it came. And here's the thing: for the rest of that dress rehearsal, and the previews, and the opening night, which is a challenge sometimes, and the whole rest of the run, I never called for a line again, and I never hesitated or. Hemmed and hawed over it. All the lines came. It was grand. You know, good, good show, good performance, well done.
But inside, terror and turmoil.
Exactly. Yeah, and if anything, it got worse, Oliver. I was kind of, you know, I didn't allow the fact, the proof, if you like, that, you know, you did it last night. Surely you can do it tonight. I didn't allow that to reassure me. So, and then I mean, jumping ahead a little bit, for the next about year and a bit, I did four other shows, a couple more in the Gate, actually. I was thinking about this, was a show in the Gaiety as well, including a show I'd done before, a Rough Magic show called Improbable Frequency. It got worse and worse. And these were shows with normal dialogue, some of them as well. They weren't all monologue shows.
But no mistakes.
No mistakes. And no calling for lines.
Just the unbelievable stress that you and anxiety you were going through.
Yeah, the fear that I would forget.
Were they panic attacks? Was it stress like exam anxiety? What was it?
Yeah, it's funny. People talk about panic attacks. I think I've had a couple of quite mild panic attacks, but not on stage. Not that sense of I'm going to faint, I'm going to vomit, I can't breathe. But I have had that once or twice in the audience, looking at shows.
Really?
Looking at someone doing a monologue. Yeah. So they, you know, go figure. But yeah, like I was safe in the audience. I thought I was safe. But I did have that feeling. I've never had it in any other context of feeling very hot, feeling claustrophobic, mm-hmm. feeling I need to get out of this auditorium now. And then the feeling that I can't get out of the auditorium. I'm in, you know, row M 32 or something. I'm in the middle of, you know, an audience. You can't ruined the show, but anyway, this is a spiral. I was fine in those instances. I didn't vomit and I didn't disturb anyone, but obviously there's a kind of a empathetic, paranoid concern for the actor on stage who's doing a monologue. Yeah. Again, exactly, thinking, how can he, both men actually, how can he do that? That's not safe. He can't do that. I don't know how he can get through that. It's mad.
In the heel of the hunt, then you stop acting on the stage. And do you go into therapy? What do you do?
I did stop. Yeah, excuse me. I did to say about four more shows. So by the end of 2012, I'd stopped doing regular productions. Mm-hmm. So I could do readings, of different types, but that's it. So if I had a script in front of me, I was fine. No nerves at all.
Which means you could do radio dramas, things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And as I say, play readings and staged readings, this sort of thing. But no, it was entirely limiting, confining. Like I couldn't make a living as an actor anymore. So what did I do? I did go see a therapist. One in particular, a couple of people I saw briefly, but one in particular, I had a lump of money from a voiceover that I'd done, or a couple of voiceovers, and I thought, this is a good way to spend this money. It was kind of CBT and
cognitive behavioral therapy works in people with depression and anxiety.
And I suppose there were some positives came from it, but it didn't work for me. It
didn't fix the stage nervousness, anxiety, the stress of it.
No, exactly. It didn't.
Did they burrow into, I presume they did, obviously, but did you discover why it suddenly hit you? You were what was going on in your life at the time? I think you were dealing with your parents who were losing their memories.
Yeah. Interestingly. You see, I've tried to piece this together rather like a detective, like when was that, you know, when was that dress rehearsal? What date was that? And of course, I kind of looked back and I could find the date. And then piecing it with when did my parents start to become kind of vulnerable, showing their need for some supports, like my father was having falls and things like that. But actually, in terms of cause and effect, it isn't very neat. No, I can't say. Yes, it was.
There's no conclusion on.
Can't blame the parents. there's nothing conclusive about it. So in the show, I ask the question without necessarily coming to a full conclusion. What are you afraid
That's
of?
That's why it's still a question in 2025. Yeah.
Exactly.
Actor Peter Hanley talking about his experience of stage fright with Oliver Callan this morning. Peter's play, What Are You Afraid Of?, has its world premiere as part of the 2025 Kilkenny Arts Festival in August. Tickets from kilkennyarts.ie. the biggest targets for far-right politicians, their supporters, and various appalling online groupings in the culture wars of recent years has been science, most notably the areas of vaccines and climate change. Mike Berners-Lee, Lancaster University professor and author of A Climate of Truth, joined Claire Byrne this morning to talk about how we have most of the technology we need to combat climate change, and most people want governments to do more, but the urgency just doesn't seem to be there.
I've looked at this question pretty seriously now because we've had 29 climate COPs over three decades, and that every year carbon emissions are still going up, not down. So I've been trying to ask, you know, what are the reasons behind the reasons why we're not getting anywhere, and the reasons behind, you know, bad decisions that get taken. And the conclusion I've come to very clearly is that they all have flat out dishonesty at their root. So the climate COPs have been sabotaged by cynical vested interests from the fossil fuel industry acting in a very clearly dishonest way. Mm-hmm. And in my country as well, I come to the same conclusions about, for example, discussions over whether we have a coal mine, open up a new coal mine. Actually, they have deceit at their root. So
why then continue with COP? Climate activists, people who actually and genuinely want to see change, will continue to travel to COP and participate in it. Why?
Well, it's not that we don't need COPs, it's just that we need to get them working properly. And if anything good came out of COP29, it was a much wider realization that we've got to stop these conferences being sabotaged by very well-funded, very cynical corporate vested interests whose intent is simply to make sure that they don't succeed in leaving the fossil fuel in the ground.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you say this is an eruption of deceit unlike anything you've known in your lifetime. Have you been able to establish how it's become acceptable to distort facts and present alternative truths? In other words, how are they getting away with it?
Well, because we've been lazy, collectively. There's been a kind of experiment with post-truth, you know, around the world. And we're seeing it going on, you know, very, very seriously in the United States at the moment. But, you know, certainly in other places as well. In the UK, we've had a very serious kind of experiment of post-truth, where we've just kind of normalized the idea that politicians lie, it's how the job's done, and that's absolutely not the case. But the really good news is that we can reframe this. Okay, so we can treat deceit very, very differently. And just by the way, what I mean by deceit is much more than just lying. I mean any attempt that anybody makes to make another person believe something that they don't actually believe is the case. So in my book, I've got a kind of whole taxonomy of deceit because it's quite a sophisticated art form. But we can insist on a different culture. We can say, look, if we get one clear-cut case of a politician deliberately misleading the public, then that is abuse. And it tells us we can't trust them. It tells us we can't trust them on anything at all. And it also tells us, actually, that we can't trust any of their colleagues who stay quiet in the knowledge that they've been deceitful. Now, we can insist on that value. And to the extent that we succeed in insisting on that value, we will raise the quality of decision making, not just about climate, but about everything we might care about, every social issue and every environmental issue. So that's what my book's calling for. And it's just like, it's so obvious. It's just like, you know, we mustn't have deceitful politicians, duh. Mm-hmm.
Mike, you did mention the United States and what's been happening there under the Trump administration. I mean, do you agree that it's more difficult now than ever before to call on people to stand up and call out misrepresentation on climate change and greenwashing?
Yes, I agree that it is becoming more difficult, and we have to wake up and stand up for it now. Mm-hmm. It's not as difficult in Ireland right now as it is in the United States. And so take your opportunity while you've got it. In the UK, we're paying a price for our experiment with post-truth and for normalizing the idea that it's okay for politicians to mislead the public. I like to think we've moved slightly in a better direction. But, you know, we need to radically raise the standards. And anyone who's feeling like, you know, there's nothing I can do to change the world, actually, you know, I think a point of greatest agency is just to be absolutely insistent on standards of honesty from our politicians, from our media, and also from the businesses that serve us.
Okay, I'm just interested in what you say about, you know, your sense that you've moved on from the experiment in the United Kingdom. You have a Labour government whose focus is solely on driving economic growth. Now, that doesn't really tally with addressing climate change.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, it's not as if our Labour government is perfect, but I do think that there's clear water between them at the moment and the very, very depressing government that we had before that was literally deceiving the public knowingly, routinely, every day. So, you know, the book I've written is explicitly not party political, or even though it does call out some examples, you know, very explicitly. But this takes me to a broader principle, which is that you may find that you have to vote for the least unfit politician that is available. And if that's the case, it's very important that you do have that vote. We're never going to have, we'll raise the standards a long way very quickly if we always vote for the least unfit politician.
Is it easier to distort the truth when the implications of inaction are intangible for some in some parts of the world still, and impenetrable for others? Because explaining the impacts of climate change, it can be a complex business.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's very easy to distort the truth. And it's very easy to say things that you know aren't true on the radio. It takes like 10 minutes to go on a radio call and say some things that sound plausible, but that you know aren't true. On the other hand, putting that back in the bag takes a lot of effort. You know, I can think of examples where in the UK where politicians have gone on air, they've said things that aren't true, and then it's taken academics days and days to carefully document how this is a load of nonsense. But even when you've done that, you haven't got the message out to the public. So given that it's so easy to spread mistruths and so difficult to put them back in the bag, we have to create a very high price for being caught out having deliberately misled in any way at all. And the way that we achieve that high price is that we say, OK, if we catch one example of a politician deliberately misleading us, that tells us they're not on their side. They're not on our side. If they were on our side, they wouldn't do that to us. So that tells us they're in the wrong job. And it also tells us that any other politicians who don't call them out on it are also not fit for the role they're in either. And by having that multiplier effect, we can actually create a climate of honesty, even though deceit is so increasingly easy.
Mm-hmm. Just on the timeline here, I mean, there are those who would say it's too late to get the deniers to face climate change and then therefore too late to confront climate change in a meaningful way.
Well, we have to face the fact that we haven't yet confronted climate change in a meaningful way. And I don't say this lightly, but the rate of carbon emissions is still going up every year, not down. So after 29 COPs, we are making the climate worse by a larger amount every year than we made it worse the year before. So that doesn't tell us we can't get on top of this, but it does tell us we absolutely need to raise our game and try something different.
Lancaster University professor and author of A Climate of Truth, Mike Berners-Lee, talking to Claire Byrne about how dishonesty is undermining the fight against climate change. Screenwriter and playwright Peter Sheridan joined Ray Darcy in studio this afternoon to talk about a revival of his play Philo.
But it started very small. It started in the Sean O'Casey Theatre in East Wall. Nice small theatre. And then we went to the Viking, which is a very small theatre. And then we got a couple of invites around after that. And just slowly and gradually, more and more people contacted me to say, we'd really, really love to see this play. So it's become a really quiet hit. And then we got an invitation to the Civic Theatre in Tallaght and the Pavilion in Dunleary, and we stuffed both of them. And I thought, brilliant, this is just extraordinary. And then the Gaiety rang me and said, we're hearing a lot about this show that you have out on the road. Would you fancy taking it in here for a week? I said, would I what?
Yeah.
Of course I would, yeah.
That's great, isn't it?
So it's just one of those things. Yeah. That, you know, you can't plan them. They just happen. You don't know what. You don't ever really know what's going to be a hit in our business.
And Philo, Philomena, is based on a woman that you met.
A woman that I met and got to know really well.
Yes.
But everybody knew her.
Right.
She was a huge personality in the Sheriff Street, East Wall area. You know, she had a big personality and a big mouth, as we'd say in Dublin, you know. And in the early 80s, I was working with an organisation in Summerhill in Dublin called the North Centre City Community Action Project, of which Tony Gregory was the chairperson. And a couple of things happened in early 1982 that were very significant in terms of our organisation. Tony stood for election. He was 33-1 on Paddy Powers to win a seat, but he actually won the last seat in the Dublin North Central constituency. And we were we had an office in 20 Summerhill Parade. And after the election, Tony held the balance of power. And suddenly...
Yeah, he was a kingmaker, yeah.
Coughey, Bertie Ahern, Brennan, they all turned up at our door looking for Tony's vote for Coughey as Taoiseach. And we had put in an application to the Department of Labour for what they called a temporary youth employment scheme at that time. Under the arts banner. They'd never given money for the arts under a temporary employment scheme, but because of the political situation that we were in, suddenly we got the word that it would be met with a different thing now. So we got this money, and not only did I get money to do an arts project, a theatre project, a drama project, but we were allowed to break the rules of the age. There was an age limit of you had to be under 25.
Right.
So they gave me a pass on that one, and I could take two or three older people.
So Flory was one of those.
And Flory was one of those, and another woman called Jean Doyle, who went on to play Rita in Fair City for 10 years.
And Flory went on to act herself.
And Flory stayed at the acting. She was more of a stand-up comedian than an actress.
Right.
But, I mean, the very first play but I did with
them... There's sort of echoes of your dad in that, isn't there? Didn't he come to acting quite late?
Yeah, really late. You know, he didn't come to it until his 40s.
Right.
You know, and that happened out of a tragedy. But, you know, Flory had this remarkable comic ability. I remember the first play we did was set in the Monto. It was called The Kips That Digs the Village, which are names that the Monto was known by. So she was playing a character that was based on Dicey Riley. You've heard of Dicey Riley.
Yeah, poor old Dicey Riley.
But she was a prostitute in the Monto.
Right.
So Flory played this character based on her, sang the song, of course, in it.
Yeah.
But her opening line in the play was she was standing outside of a house and a client comes along and he says to her, excuse me, I was looking for a woman. Are you poor? She says, am I poor? I'm not poor, I'm a whore. And the entire theatre erupted. And it was like, you know, because everybody's so nervous on an opening night. And we just knew we were home. And just Flory was just like, she knocked them for 10, you know.
And
she just had this amazing ability.
Has died, didn't
she? Yeah, she passed away about 8 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
So she hasn't seen Philo.
No, but I wrote a book earlier in 2004 called Big Fat Love. And, you know, I talked to her, I mean, for hours and hours over many, many days and nights. I recorded her hours and hours of tapes because I just wanted to get her entire backstory.
Yeah.
Some you use, some you don't. But the character was inspired by her is the way I describe it. And I wrote this book, which was very successful in Ireland, Big Fat Love, and people loved it. But I always wanted to put that character on stage.
Right.
And trying to, you know, obviously it's always really difficult to find the right actress, you know, and then there was another car. I mean, I knew I didn't want it to be a one person show, so I put her in with this nun because when I actually auditioned her for the drama, she was working in a convent off Sheriff Street, making dinners and doing the bingo numbers.
So that's the setting for Philo as well.
And that's the setting for Philo. Yeah. That was the setting for the book.
So there's Philo, Philomena, and then the nun.
And then the nun.
Yeah.
And the nun was kind of based on a nun who came on an arts programme that I ran in the mid-80s.
Right.
And she was looking to renew her vocation and she just wanted to do something different. So she came and worked with me for almost a year in this arts project and she was a fantastic person. And
using people as real-life people as inspiration.
But that's all writers ever do.
Yeah.
People always kind of...
But has it been spotted? Has somebody ever said, that's me? Or...
Well, you know, I always go back to Sean O'Casey. Sean O'Casey was sued by many, many people in East Wall because he named all the characters after the people who lived in the area. Right. And they sued him. Like, Flutergood's a real person.
Right, right.
Captain Boyle was a real person.
Yeah.
There was a guy called Jock Sardade. He didn't change the names. And they sued him. And then they got small money off him. Right. But loads of them did get money off him in the courts.
Yeah.
You know?
So East Wall is where you're from. I've spoken to Jim, obviously, about
yeah.
it. So there was, what is it? One girl and six boys.
And correct.
Yeah, Frankie then died at
And then
the age
Frankie
of 11.
Died in 67.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, on the 17th of April.
Did you have lodgers as well?
We had lodgers as well, yeah. The lodgers were great.
Yeah, the lodgers like were great. What class of lodger did you have?
Well, they were usually country fellas. My mum was a country woman from right. Dundalk who had grown up mainly in Belfast because her own mother died in childbirth having her.
Right.
So my ma had this big thing about being a mam, being a mother. And minding everybody and loving everybody. So as part of kind of paying for our education, my ma took in these lodgers. In fact, when I wrote my book, 44, the opening scene is my da writing out the ad for the newspaper, attracting the lodgers in. 44 Seville Place. Lodgings available, centre city location, all modern conveniences, you know, just with my dad, you know. And then, of course, the lodgers turned up and my ma interviewed them.
Right.
Took them in. And, of course, she couldn't say no. We were supposed to take two lodgers. We ended up with six because my ma couldn't turn people away.
Yeah.
So they were all over the house, you know. So some of them slept in the same room as myself and Jim, who was Seamus, of course, to my ma, or Shay to us. So the lives of the lodgers and our lives kind of interacted madly, right. Really madly, you know, but so brilliantly as well.
Playwright Peter Sheridan talking about his play Philo, which runs at the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin next month. Tickets can be booked on gaietytheatre.ie. And that's all I have for you on this end of first quarter edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has a good, better, best look back at an entire week in radio. For me, though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck. Oh yeah.